I'm Danuta. I'm from Poland. You listen you to Soundcheck. WNYC.
I wanna go where you go. Do what you do. Love when you love, and I'll be happy.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The story of the singer, actress, and activist Josephine Baker has many chapters. She rose to fame as a risque hot jazz act in 1920s Paris. Performing in her trademark banana skirt, Baker was a muse for artists and writers like Langston Hughes and Pablo Picasso. During World War II, she gathered intelligence for the French resistance and earned a French War Cross. In the 1950s and 60s, she became a figure in the American Civil Rights Movement. But there's another chapter in Josephine Baker's story that you might not know about, and a new book focuses on it. It's called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe. Matthew Pratt Gutterl is the author. He's also professor of Africana Studies and American Studies at Brown University. Matthew, welcome to Soundcheck.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what does the title Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe refer to specifically?
So the Rainbow Tribe is the family that she assembles starting in the early 1950s and builds through the early 1960s. She gives it a name, the Rainbow Tribe, as a way to sort of connect it to visions of common humanity, multiculturalism, multiracialism.
So she assembles the family.
Yes, quite deliberately.
Mm-hmm. And is specifically trying to, you know, kind of cross races and ethnicity and religion with her family.
Yes, as carefully and as deliberately as she can, she's looking for balance and representation across the spectrum of colors and races and peoples. And she wants a family that serves a deeply symbolic purpose in the context of conversations about decolonization, civil rights, human rights.
Where is she in her career at this point? You say this is like the 1950s, and we think of Josephine Baker as very much a person of the 20s and maybe 30s.
You know, it's interesting. She was rumored to have died during World War II and had a major comeback in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and had a fairly successful tour of the United States, which ended rather dramatically with her confrontation with a U.S. journalist and her labeling as a communist and her blackballing in the U.S., and she was sort of pushed adrift. Sent down ultimately through Brazil to Argentina, where she spoke out angrily and vociferously against Jim Crow. So she's had the successful career, but she's now at political odds with the culture of the United States, and she returns to France in that context and begins these adoptions.
Well, you know, for folks who know the name Josephine Baker and can't quite place her, here is one of her great hits from those early days, and the song is called J'ai deux amours, I Have Two Loves. Little bit of Josephine Baker's recording of J'ai deux amours, I Have Two Loves, a career that began with kind of salacious dancing in Paris in the 1920s. She was, though, Matthew, a serious artist, you know, felt very strongly about her music and her stage presence. And, you know, we begin, as she matures as an artist, as a person, we begin to see these other sides of her. The Rainbow Tribe, at what point does she come to the conclusion that her own experience as a black woman in Europe needs to have some kind of additional outlet other than on stage?
That's a great question. I mean, I think she's always more than her stage persona. She's advertising products. She's creating
what we would now call a brand.
Yes, a brand. She's attempting to incorporate herself, right, in the language of Oprah. And she's always looking for accompaniments as well. So on stage or on screen, she often has, you know, pets, small children, lovers. She's never really alone except for a few scenes in a few movies. She often has something with her, a compliment of some kind.
Oh, miss, vous avez donné tout. Et moi, j'en vous laisse un petit bout. Pour voir si vous avez raison de trouver ça si bon.
Ne vous désolez pas, voyons.
But it's really after World War II, and specifically after her trip to Argentina, that she comes to the idea that a bigger ensemble, supporting cast of young children could be brought together to augment her personality, to indicate direction, where she thought the world should go, and to give some sense of her role in human history.
And in terms of having kids of her own, it's important to say that every member of the Rainbow Tribe was adopted, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So just the fact that she spent some of the war years, you know, working for the French Resistance shows that, you know, already she was thinking in terms of her place in the world. And the Rainbow Tribe kind of reflects this sort of global embrace. She wanted to adopt an Israeli kid. She wanted a Jewish member of the family. And that didn't quite work out, right?
No, she wanted to. There were several attempted adoptions that never really came to pass. So one was her effort to secure an Israeli child, which she wasn't where she failed, primarily because the state of Israel desperately needed human capital. And
they said, why would we send an Israeli kid to you when we're trying to get Jewish kids to come to Israel?
Exactly. Yeah. So she adopted a child from France and assigned him a Jewish identity. She also wanted to adopt a Native American child, and that too fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. But she managed to find another child who was indigenous, though from South America, and to include him in the family too.
And they all lived in this remarkable place that is, to contemporary readers, might strike echoes of Michael Jackson's Neverland and Disneyland. And tell us about her little world. Yeah. For the Rainbow Tribe.
It's an extraordinary place. And if anybody who's listening ever has a chance to go to the Dordogne, they should go to Les Milans, which is now a museum run by a lovely woman who was very helpful to me. It's a big old castle that Baker painstakingly restored in the 1940s and that she turned into a theme park with amusement car rides and polo courts and tennis courts and canoe rides and a series of bars and hotels. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of this, there was the domestic site of the castle itself. Much like Disneyland and Disney World, the castle sits at the middle of the enterprise, and the family was raised there.
And this is where the story begins to get a little more unusual and perhaps for contemporary sensibilities, a little more complex, because you call it a theme park. And who are the star attractions in this theme park?
Well, the star attractions are the children themselves. That what's being advertised here is a vision of the future, and Baker encourages her public in France and globally to come visit the Dordogne and to come to Les Milans and to see what the future might look like, to watch these children play together out in the public air. And so there are a series of glorious photographs that I included in the book of Baker playing with the children in front of the closed gate. The audience is outside anticipating entry. Everyone's staring at the children and watching them. And it's important to remember that this is 1953, 54, 55. You know, this is a fairly radical vision at the time. This is the moment at which swimming pools are being closed. You know, the Brown decision has just passed. In the U.S. side of things, the racial situation is getting worse, not better in the short term.
We're speaking with Matthew Pratt Goodirl. He's the author of the book called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe. 12 kids, is that right?
That's right.
And it becomes kind of an extension of her own performing career. There's a song that she did earlier on called Dans Mon Village, In My Village, which after the family breaks up, and we can talk about how that happens in a moment, but throughout the 1960s, she continues to sing this older song, and the resonance and the meaning of the lyrics about, you know, a village where people can gather and can serve all men as bright witness, it has changed for her and for her audience because of what she's gone through.
No, exactly. When she has the children on site at Les Milans and she's performing for people who are visiting, she has a small theater down by the river that she uses to perform. She'll bring the children out, or the children will be in the front row and she'll gesture to them. Later in life, when the children have grown up grown up and are no longer the kind of petite, easily controlled symbols that they once were, she will bring small children up from the audience and have them sit on stage around her and sing to them. So they become a very stylized, very It's a Small World referent for yeah. her.
The song is Dans mon village, Josephine Baker.
Dans mon village, tout ça qu'il m'aimait. Dans mon village, tout ça qu'il grandiront. Et comme moi, je sais qu'un jour, ils chanteront les deux amours. Ce beau village, et puis celui de leur pays.
Josephine Baker singing Dans mon village, kind of, well, as Matthew has said, it's kind of her version of It's a Small World After All, this hope that people can be seen without thought of race or color, as the lyrics say. Matthew Pratt Goodearl is professor of Africana Studies and American Studies at Brown University. His book is called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe, about Josephine Baker's quixotic attempt to create a kind of multiracial, multi-ethnic, multinational family. And Matthew, for you, this is personal, isn't it?
In a way, yes. You know, I come from a fairly large, though not quite that large, adoptive family, raised in a small town in a house with a white picket fence. My parents had many reasons to adopt, but among them, my father used to say, was the desire to sort of bring together people of different races. He often said that jokingly, so I'm never sure whether he was serious, but it's interesting that that language was out there. And I remember vividly as a child multiple instances where the three of us who were closest in age and who represented, you know, the three great racial divisions of the world or whatever, were brought out to deliver the gifts up to the altar at a holiday mass, or I often felt on display, or felt as if I was serving some kind of symbolic purpose, not necessarily for my parents, but for people in the town. And the number of times I heard people say, your father's a saint, your parents are saints. It's a very interesting experience as a child to imagine that your parents, in creating this family, have contributed to a kind of human rights or civil rights mission.
And did you at some point begin to think, well, I don't want to be on display, you know. I'm a teenager now. I'm too cool for this stuff. I mean, you know.
Yeah, no, I always, quite frankly, hated that feeling of surveillance and public watching, and always wished to fade into the background. And it was incredibly difficult. Didn't help that my father had a Suburban that was bright orange and sort of called attention to the family. But
so the family mobile would come down the street and everyone
yes,
knew what that
right,
meant.
Exactly.
So Josephine Baker herself, she dies suddenly in 1975. The family, you know, has sort of broken up in the 60s. What happened to the kids? I mean, do they still think of each other as family, as siblings? Do they maintain contact?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what happens, she dies a classic entertainer's death, right? So on the eve of her last great performance, and the family is split up largely because the younger children are in various kinds of educational institutions, some of them in boarding schools, some of them with friends and relatives. The older children are living in apartments and are on their own. And they have to come together at this great final funeral in Paris. And I think they do come together. I know that they continue to think of each other as family. They're in touch. They have a network. They're split by generational demographics, it seems to me, that there's definitely an older group and a younger group.
Well, that's normal for a big – I mean, I'm from a large family, and I know my younger brothers and sisters. I'm more like an uncle to them than an older brother. So that dynamic, you know, certainly is – for Josephine Baker, was this experiment a success?
You know, that's another great question. I think it was a success in some ways, but probably not in others. I think that she was displeased with the way that it ended. And, you know, because she, as much as she imagined these children as symbolically important in her battle for civil and human rights, she also recognized, not always completely and sometimes episodically, that they were also children who required a mother and a parent, that they were complex emotional creatures and human beings. At times, she seems much more invested in the symbolic function of the children, especially as a group, than she is in the inner lives or complexities of each individual child. That's kind of a feature of some of these large adoptive families as well, this sense, as Dorothy DeBolt once put it, that you don't need to know the names of your children. You just deal with the bigger issues when they're in front of you.
Well, there were some pretty big issues that Josephine Baker was facing throughout her life, and which certainly color the story in Matthew Pratt Goodrell's book. It's called Josephine Baker and the Rainbow Tribe. It is out now, and it is really just one more astonishing chapter in what was an amazing life story. So, Matthew, thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Soundcheck is a production of WNYC in New York. Find out more about our show at soundcheck.org or just download the new WNYC mobile app. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.